This is Americana.
Let us be done with all this talk of anything you may happen to dislike in the daily headlines. Let us talk of the realities that do not change, of that higher realism which is the only true romance. Let us talk again of Sherlock Holmes. For the plain fact is, gentlemen, that the imperishable detective is still a more commanding figure in the world than most of the warriors and statesmen in whose present existence we are invited to believe.
The words you have just heard were from Vincent Sterrett's introduction to a book entitled 221B, Studies in Sherlock Holmes. This program is Americana, the 31st in a series of radio essays on the American scene, presented each week by Northwestern University in cooperation with station WMAQ. Tonight we bring you Mr. Sherlock Holmes in America.
Good evening. I'm Martin Maloney of the School of Speech at Northwestern University. There are some childhood experiences that we always remember. I don't mean here to refer to the findings of the late Dr. Freud. I'm talking, rather, about the experiences we are willing to remember and even to admit remembering. One such experience for me was the discovery of the life and activities of Mr. Sherlock Holmes. I can still remember the book in which I first read of the great man's life. It was a red, cloth-covered volume, one of a set of the works of Conan Doyle, which in those days must have been sold by book peddlers from door to door. On the spine of the book, in modest gold letters, appeared the words, "The Return of Sherlock Holmes." I wasn't impressed by this. It was the first time I'd heard that Mr. Holmes had been away. I opened the book, at any rate, and in a moment found myself in the company of John Watson, M.D.
It was in the spring of the year 1894 that all London was interested and the fashionable world dismayed by the murder of the Honorable Ronald Adair under most unusual and inexplicable circumstances. The public has already learned those particulars of the crime which came out in the police investigation, but a good deal was suppressed upon that occasion, since the case for the prosecution was so overwhelmingly strong that it was not necessary to bring forward all the facts. Only now, at the end of nearly 10 years, am I allowed to supply those missing links which make up the whole of that remarkable chain.
This seemed promising enough, and so I followed along as Dr. Watson conducted his somewhat naive investigation of the death of Ronald Adair. I was, of course, struck by his encounter before the Adair residence with the elderly bookseller.
I struck against an elderly, deformed man who had been behind me, and I knocked down several books which he was carrying. I remember that as I picked them up, I observed the title of one of them, The Origin of Tree Worship. And it struck me that the fellow must be some poor bibliophile who either as a trade or as a hobby was a collector of obscure volumes. I endeavored to apologize for the accident, but it was evident that these books which I had so unfortunately maltreated were very precious objects in the eyes of their owner. With a snarl of contempt, he turned upon his heel, and I saw his curved back and white side whiskers disappear among the throng.
And I was properly amazed when a page later, the selfsame bookseller turned up at Watson's rooms to apologize for his rude behavior.
Well, I have a conscience, sir, and when I chanced to see you go into this house, as I came hobbling after you, I thought to myself, I'll just step in and see that kind gentleman and tell him that if I was a bit gruff in my manner, there was not any harm meant, and that I am much obliged to him for picking up my books.
You make too much of a trifle, I said. May I ask how you knew who I was?
Well, sir, if it isn't too great a liberty, I'm a neighbor of yours. For you'll find my little bookshop at the corner of Church Street, and very happy to see you, I'm sure. Maybe you collect yourself, sir. Here's British Birds and Catullus and the Holy War. A bargain, every one of them. With 5 volumes, you could just fill that gap on the second shelf. It looks untidy. Does it not, sir?
Well, I moved my head to look at the cabinet behind me, and when I turned again, Sherlock Holmes was standing smiling at me across my study table. I rose to my feet. I stared at him for some seconds in utter amazement, and then it appears that I must have fainted for the first and last time in my life. Certainly a gray mist swirled before my eyes, and when it cleared, I found my collar ends undone and the tingling aftertaste of brandy upon my lips. Holmes was bending over my chair, his flask in his hand. Said the well-remembered voice,
"My dear Watson, I owe you 1,000 apologies. I had no idea that you would be so affected."
This was magnificent. I don't suppose that I have ever entirely recovered from reading this remarkable account, or from discovering that Mr. Holmes made his way so easily out of the Reichenbach chasm for the excellent reason that he was never in it. And as for the scene in which Holmes traps Colonel Sebastian Moran, the second most dangerous man in London, well, words fail me. I must surely have gone from reading The Return of Sherlock Holmes to continue with The Hound of the Baskervilles, for in that novel occurs one of my favorite passages in literature. Dr. James Mortimer, that keen amateur of science, has just read the old accounts of the spectral hound, which is the symbol of the Baskerville curse, and now he launches into his story of the strange death of the late baronet.
On the night of Sir Charles' death, Barrymore, the butler who made the discovery, sent Perkins, the groom, on horseback to me. And as I was sitting up late, I was able to reach Baskerville Hall within an hour of the event. I checked and corroborated all the facts which were mentioned at the inquest. I followed the footsteps down the yew alley. I saw the spot at the moor gate where he seemed to have waited. I remarked the change in the shape of the prints after that point. I noted that there were no other footsteps save those of Barrymore in the soft gravel. And finally, I carefully examined the body which had not been touched until my arrival. Sir Charles lay on his face, his arms out, his fingers dug into the ground, and his features convulsed with some strong emotion to such an extent that I could hardly have sworn to his identity. There was certainly no physical injury of any kind, but one false statement was made by Barrymore at the inquest. He said that there were no traces upon the ground round the body. He did not observe any. But I did, some little distance off, but fresh and clear. Huh? Footprints? Yes. Footprints. Were they a man's or a woman's?
Dr. Mortimer looked strangely at us for an instant, and his voice sank almost to a whisper as he answered,
"Mr. Holmes, they were the footprints of a gigantic hound."
I must not let myself become involved any deeper in this sort of thing. It's entirely possible to spend hours on end quoting the sacred writings, which is, I believe, Mr. Christopher Morley's term for the Holmes stories. Nobody who encountered these tales, as I did, and there must have been many who did, ever read them. Memorized is the proper term. The woods are full of more or less sober and decidedly middle-aged citizens who can quote Holmes as pertinently as a 19th-century British parliamentarian could quote Shakespeare. This sort of enthusiasm always promotes more writing. I have for years, ever since Doyle published his last Holmes short story, been reading imitations and burlesques of the Holmes canon. Mr. August Derleth, the Wisconsin scribe, has in late years performed a public service by issuing 2 volumes of excellent stories about an eminent detective named Solar Pons. The name is different, but the accent is pretty much the same. Only the other day, I was happy to find that Adrian Conan Doyle and John Dixon Carr had published a new volume of tales called The Exploits of Sherlock Holmes. Vincent Sterrett, in reviewing the book, remarked that the stories were imitations rather than a series of new originals. But he added, and I agree, that they are very good, very welcome imitations. Thus, the opening of the tale called The Adventure of the Red Widow.
Your conclusions are perfectly correct, my dear Watson. Squalor and poverty are the natural matrix to crimes and violence.
Well, yes. Precisely so, I agreed. Indeed, I was just thinking. I broke off to stare at him in amazement. Oh, good heavens, Holmes, I cried. This is too much. How could you possibly know my innermost thoughts? My friend leaned back in his chair and, placing his fingertips together, surveyed me from under his heavy, drooping eyelids.
I would do better justice, perhaps, to my limited powers by refusing to answer your question. You have a certain flair, Watson, for concealing your failure to perceive the obvious by the cavalier manner in which you invariably accept the explanation of a sequence of simple but logical reasoning.
Well, I don't see how logical reasoning can enable you to follow the course of my mental processes, I retorted, a trifle nettled by his superior manner.
Needless to say, Watson is here about to be astounded by Holmes's incredible deductions, thus demonstrating his nearly infinite capacity for astonishment, since the same thing has happened to him at least 3 times before in much the same way. I imagine that most of us who have read the more serious studies of the lives and careers of Holmes and Watson came upon them rather late in the game. I can't remember when I first heard of the Baker Street Irregulars, a society of eminent and learned men devoted to Holmesiana. I think it was before I read Mr. Sterrett's The Private Life of Sherlock Holmes, or 221B, Studies in Sherlock Holmes, but I'm not sure. It was in this latter volume, at any rate, that I read such delightful pieces as Elmer Davis's On the Emotional Geology of Baker Street, and Christopher Morley's Was Sherlock Holmes an American?
Was Holmes actually of American birth? It would explain much. The jealousy of Scotland Yard, the refusal of knighthood, the expert use of Western argot, the offhand behavior to aristocratic clients, the easy camaraderie with working people of all sorts, the always traveling first class in trains. How significant is Holmes, when he notes that Irene Adler was born in New Jersey, and Watson's careful insertion of USA after every American address, which always irritates us, is probably a twit to tease his principal. True, as Inspector MacDonald once said, you don't need to import an American from outside in order to account for American doings.
But of all such critical and biographical works, the best and richest array may be found in a remarkable publication called the Baker Street Journal, which was published between 1946 and 1949 on behalf of the Baker Street Irregulars by an old friend of mine, a distinguished Chicago publisher, connoisseur of letters, and bookseller, Ben Abramson of Argus Books. I can best give you some notion of the quality of the Baker Street Journal by sampling for you a notice of a biography of Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, which appeared in 1949 in the Journal.
The Baker Street Irregulars everywhere will note with pride and wholly without prejudice the publication on February 2nd of John Dixon Carr's authoritative biography of Sherlock Holmes' great and good friend, Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. Mr. Carr has told the story of this many-sided man for whom, be it said, no group has a higher admiration than the Irregulars themselves, better than anyone has told it before. Mr. Carr makes it abundantly clear that Conan Doyle was a great sportsman, a great painter, a great crusader, a great writer. He was, above all, a great historical novelist. The White Company is still one of the best 3 or 4 books that have been written in its field. And he has given us also such diverse pieces, all profoundly researched, as Sir Nigel, Micah Clarke, Rodney Stone, and The Refugees. The Brigadier Gerard stories catch the flavor of the Napoleonic Wars as truly, because as unconsciously, as Dr. Watson's saga of Sherlock Holmes reflects the aura of London and of London's England in the 90s. There will be surely no readers of the Sherlock Holmes tales who will not wish also to read this life of a man who walked and talked with Sherlock Holmes.
Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, who assisted in preparing Dr. Watson's manuscripts for publication, was an Englishman. So undeniably was Dr. Watson. I agree with Mr. Morley that Holmes himself must have had an American connection, and surely the appearance of the Baker Street Irregulars and their journal fall into the realm of Americana. On this assumption, I asked Ben Abramson if he would permit me to interview him on the subject of the irregulars and the journal. He agreed and was good enough to come to the studio tonight and is at this moment sitting across the table from me. Ben, let me ask you, how did the Baker Street Journal come to be published?
It was decided at a meeting of the Baker Street Irregulars that some permanent form should be found in which could be preserved the investigations, studies, and writings concerning Mr. Holmes and Dr. Watson. Mr. Christopher Morley was appointed editor. There was an editorial staff. There was a cartographer to draw the maps. There was a herald to draw the coats of arms. And other duties were performed by various other persons who had become members of the Irregulars.
The journal, I think I'm right in saying that it was published from 46 to 49?
That is true, yes.
Do you expect that it will ever be resumed?
I hope to revive it again sometime in the future.
I wonder if you'd tell us a little about the Baker Street Irregulars, how they got started, for example.
Well, the Baker Street Irregulars got started through the fact that Christopher Morley, who was then writing for the Saturday Review, printed a crossword puzzle composed by his brother Frank and concerning the canonical, as we call them, the canonical writings. Morley suggested that anybody who could solve the puzzle might become a member of a group which was then being contemplated, the Baker Street Irregulars. At the first meeting, Elmer Davis, Alexander Wolcott, Christopher Morley, Edgar Smith, and a few others attended. Since then, it has grown and expanded because of the necessity to keep the Irregulars in New York City. The society abetted the formation of what are called science societies.
Oh, are there many of these?
There are now 28 in the United States. In Chicago here, we have the Hounds Sick of the Baskerville, of which Mr. Vincent Starrett is the needle. There are in Minneapolis, the Norwegian Explorers, in Los Angeles, 17 Steps, in Providence, the Dancing Men, the Red-Headed League in New Orleans, and so on.
Oh, these titles are wonderful. I think you told me, too, that within the National Society, there are titles that are allotted to individuals. You have a title, for example.
Yes, there is what they are called titular investitures. And that is limited, of course, to 60, since there are just the 60 adventures.
What is your own title?
Mine is the Beryl Coronet, which is 11th in the hierarchy. Vincent Starrett is properly a Study in Scarlet, number one. And what? Christopher Morley is number two, the Sign of the Four.
I see. And what are some of the others? These I don't suppose we need to explain it, but they are titles.
The actual adventures in the... arranged in the sequence in which they were published. Mr. S.C. Roberts of Cambridge in England is the Scandal in Bohemia. And so far there have been only 15 investitures, because before such an award is made, the prospective person has to pass a very rigid examination in the Sherlockian works.
And there are only 15 so far.
15 so far who have qualified.
I see. What are the nature of your sessions in the Baker Street Irregulars? What do you do?
Well, there are, first of all, the canonical toasts are drunk. One is to the woman, Irene Adler, to whom, as you may remember, Sherlock Holmes said she would always be the woman. Another to Mrs. Hudson, the landlady at 221B. A third to Mycroft Holmes. And a fourth to Dr. Watson's second wife. After the drinking of the four canonical toasts, papers are read, very learned disquisitions concerning some aspect of an activity of Holmes, or perhaps an anachronism or a contradiction in the writings, because it appears that Watson often erred in recording.
Could you give us an example?
Well, yes. For example, he mentions the fact that his leg ached from a wound that he had received in Afghanistan, but on another occasion, it's his shoulder that aches. And the question of where was Watson wounded becomes pertinent and a subject for investigation. The late James Keddie, Sr. of Boston, in his piece, Dr. Watson's Wound, establishes the fact that he was wounded neither in the shoulder nor in the leg, but rather in a portion of his exposed anatomy as he was lying over a horse.
Well, I'm glad that's finally been settled.
other inquiries concern where Dr. Watson, where Sherlock Holmes went to school. Was it Cambridge or Oxford? How many times was Watson married? Some say only once to Mary Morstan. Some have established the fact that he was married twice, and another that he was married three times. Dr. Ronald Hammond, for example, a member from Providence, a well-known surgeon, read a paper on the attempted mayhem of Silver Blaze. He had a big chart on the wall showing the anatomy of the horse's leg, the knife that Straker tried to use, and the fact that he couldn't have committed that crime even if he had been allowed to proceed with it.
I think there was a medical study of the one in which you have the snake going through the transom.
That was in the speckled band.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
The first girl who was killed, bitten by the snake, was in convulsions for about 3 hours until finally she died. But when the attempt was made on the second daughter and Holmes and Watson drove the snake back through the transom, they rushed into Dr. Rylott's room and found that he'd been died almost instantly after being bitten, and consequently, it was clear that a more venomous snake had been used in the second case than in the first, and Dr. Rolf Boswell of Columbia made researches into the matter. He consulted with Dr. Ditmars, the great herpetologist at the American Academy of Natural Science, and came to the conclusion that the second snake was Jameson's snake, and then he read a paper on the subject, gave the characteristics of the snake, showed that it was 17 inches long approximately, and then held up a tape measure to show how long 17 inches was, that its skin was a chocolate brown color, and he held up a Hershey bar to show the color of chocolate brown. And when he concluded his rather long but interesting talk and establishing the fact that there was a second snake, that the first one either died or escaped, Mr. Anthony Boucher of San Francisco said that Dr. Boswell had delivered a very ingenious and certainly a very studious paper, but that unfortunately his researches were inaccurate, that there was in fact only one snake, and that Dr. Rylott had died not of snake bite, but of heart failure.
Oh, these are wonderful things. Ben, in your capacity as a bookseller, do you actually encounter very many people who are convinced that Sherlock Holmes was a real person?
Oh, not only in my capacity as a bookseller do I encounter it, but I encounter it in the capacity of just being a human being walking around. And in that, I'm no different than many others throughout the world. During the First World War, when the English first landed in France, one of the generals of the French army asked the English general if they had brought along Sherlock Holmes to help them in their spying and secret activities.
And they had, presumably.
Well, they apparently had. But I should say that throughout the world, in America as well as elsewhere, more people believe that Sherlock Holmes was a real person than who know that he was a fictional creation.
One other thing that interests me a great deal, the members of the Baker Street Irregulars are certainly learned and presumably busy men. Why do they spend their time in this sort of society? What would you say is the point of this whole business?
Well, in the first place, it gives them a chance to exercise their logical and investigative faculties. In the second place, it is, in a sense, useless. And that is important to me, it seems, to be able to do useless things that hurt nobody and amuse many. It's a thing that is found in free countries only. A society of regulars could not possibly exist in Russia or any of the fascist or Soviet countries. It's only here in America and in England, where there is freedom, that such organizations can exist to provide gaiety and merriment for individuals and for mankind as a whole.
Have you ever encountered anyone who objected to the existence of the irregulars or the journal?
Oh, yes. Every once in a while, one encounters it, and for several reasons. One man came to me one time and said, here, during this paper shortage, when there are so many significant, vital questions facing us, problems that ought to be resolved, you spend your time and waste this paper on this useless activity. And I said, very well. Next issue, will contain material of exactly the same kind, but I'll print and cross the cover. This magazine is full of social significance.
I hope that satisfied him.
Yes, it did.
One further question, if you will. Why do you suppose that people pick on Holmes rather than another character?
It is difficult to answer that because different people are attracted for different reasons. But it seems to me that in Holmes, one sees reflected a kind of human wisdom, a kindness. Even though it deals so much with crime, Holmes becomes a person to be admired. He has a personality which most other fictional detectives lack.
Thank you very much, Mr. Abramson. I think I can surely add no more to Mr. Abramson's account of the great world of the Baker Street Irregulars. And instead, I'd like to leave the last word on this subject with Mr. Vincent Starrett.
Let us talk of the realities that do not change, of that higher realism which is the only true romance. Let us talk again of Sherlock Holmes. For the plain fact is, gentlemen, that the imperishable detective is still a more commanding figure in the world than most of the warriors and statesmen in whose present existence we are invited to believe. You have been listening to Americana, the 31st in a series of radio essays dealing with American history and American living, presented each week by Northwestern University in cooperation with station WMAQ. Americana is written and narrated by Martin Malone and is presented with myself, Bill Grisky, as reader. Direction is by Ralph Knowles, music supervision by Larry Johnson, engineering by Harold Whittebury. The books mentioned on tonight's program were Vincent Starrett's The Private Life of Sherlock Holmes and 221B, Studies in Sherlock Holmes, The Exploits of Sherlock Holmes by John Dixon Carr and Adrian Conan Doyle, published by Doubleday and Company, and The Baker Street Journal, published by August Books of Chicago. The works of Sir Arthur Conan Doyle may be found in various editions. We wish to thank Mr. Ben Abramson of August Books for having been with us this evening, and for giving us such interesting data on the Baker Street Journal and the Baker Street Irregulars. If you wish a list of the books discussed on this program, please send your name and address on a postcard to Americana, care of the School of Speech, Northwestern University, Evanston, Illinois, and a free copy will be sent to you. This is the NBC Radio Network. NBC chimes ring out good times on WMAQ tonight. For homespun humor, hear Fibber McGee and Molly at this dial station at 9 o'clock.